Welcome to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast for the week ending July 30th. This is podcast number 96. I'm Joe Elia. We've been on a two-week hiatus and will be gone next week as well, taking advantage of the weather and the slower medical news cycle. But medical news and medical research have not slowed to a standstill by any means. Our interview comes first, and then a look at recent clinical news. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. The Lancet last week offered a study that seems to answer a question. Does the receipt of radiation therapy during childhood lead to stillbirths and neonatal deaths during the reproductive years? The answer is, apparently not. Unless the radiation encompassed the pelvic area of a young girl, young boys with gonadal irradiation showed no increased perinatal risks in their offspring. Here to discuss why this is so is the paper's senior author, Dr. John Boyce. Dr. Boyce is a professor of medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine and the scientific director of the International Epidemiology Institute in Rockville, Maryland. His research focuses on the epidemiology of radiation effects. Welcome, Dr. Boyce.
Nice to be here, Joe.
You studied the outcomes of almost 5,000 pregnancies among 2,800 survivors of childhood cancer, both boys and girls. In your design, the risks among those who received radiation were compared with those with the risks among survivors who were treated without radiation, right?
Yes, that's correct. We looked at dose-response relationships.
Okay. And did I overstate the findings in my introduction when I said it seems to have answered a question? Is it fair to say that this research has answered a question?
I think so. At least it's gone a long ways to answer the question on whether irradiation of the testicles or the ovaries can be related to genetic effects. And the study appeared to remove that as a likelihood of causing genetic effects as demonstrated by an increase in stillbirth or neonatal death. On the other hand, we did find a substantial risk associated with pelvic irradiation. Actually, it was irradiation of the uterus of young girls who had not reached puberty as yet. And in that instance, we found for those that received high doses to their uterus that the risk of stillbirth and early death after the birth of a child reached as high as sevenfold.
And why do you, I've read your paper, but I would like to hear from you. Why do you think that that is so? If that effect wasn't seen among boys who received radiation to the testes, why would it be so among girls?
Well, it has to do with a somatic effect, and that's a direct effect of high doses of radiation on the uterus, the immature uterus that is not yet developed. So it's actually damage to the uterine structure or the blood flow that results in perhaps increased fibrosis of the uterus, less elasticity, so that during a pregnancy, the fetus is not able to grow effectively in the womb, and therefore that can result in premature labor, premature birth, low birth weight, and in these instances that we studied can result to a serious outcome such as a stillbirth or a neonatal death.
So the effect seems mechanical as opposed to genetic.
Oh, definitely. I think we can rule out a genetic effect in this study, in particular even among the women, because the women or the young girls who had been treated past menarche, past the time when they had their first period in their teenage years, there was no association with ovarian dose or uterine dose. It was only the prepubertal girls who had immature uterus that demonstrated the effect.
Now, you didn't examine birth defects among the children of these survivors, did you, in this study?
Not in this study, although we are examining them, and in the next few months we should be able to have a companion paper, if you will, that looks at birth defects, cytogenetic abnormalities, single gene defects, in the offspring. We have, however, conducted other studies in Denmark and in Finland, in large-scale studies of childhood cancer survivors, looking at these defects, and to date, there really is little evidence to suggest that even that there might be an association with malformations or birth defects following the radiotherapy or the chemotherapy exposures.
Now, is it possible that the reason for that lack of an effect would be that I think you say in your paper that the earliest stages of conception don't survive if there's a genetic defect?
Often. Oh, yes, definitely. And I think the terminology is a biological filtration system that we might have in humans, so that embryos that are defective in some way are not allowed to even implant or grow to term, and that there is a normal cleansing in the human populations of these bad embryos, if you will, so that they do not develop to term and manifest as birth defects.
Were similar findings found among atomic bomb survivors?
Exactly so. That's a very good point. The studies of the survivor, the children of the atomic bomb survivors, have actually been going on since 1945, and they continue today, some 60 years later. And in the offspring of the atomic bomb survivors, many tens of thousands of children have been studied. There is no evidence for an increase of stillbirth, neonatal death, birth defects, cancer. There is no evidence for any indication of a genetic effect that was transmitted from the whole body exposures to the atomic bombs that would have manifested themselves in the children of the A-bomb survivors.
So were you surprised by the findings in this research that you've just completed?
Not really. You know, the doses that we had been able to study because of cancer therapy were a bit higher than the doses that were experienced in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And over the years, it has been clear that young girls treated for Wilms tumor and some of the and for leukemia that had spinal irradiation, that they did have problem pregnancies. So that's been known for some time. What we were able to do is actually make a distinction on what the dose levels might be for concern about a problem pregnancy, and the age difference was now more clearly defined, that it's the young girls, those that have not yet had their period, who are being treated, that have the future problem of a potential problem pregnancy.
So the message for clinicians is what in this case?
Well, the radiation, of course, is causing cure for the cancer survivor, so that's a very, very good thing. Mm-hmm. And now we have become more concerned now, not just with survival, but quality of life after survival. And many, in this instance, many cancer survivors now are able to have children of their own. Quick aside, is, you know, a large problem of cancer therapy is infertility, so that the survivors are not able to have kids. Mm-hmm. But now, for those that are able to have kids, they should not be discouraged from doing so. But for the young girls who were treated, they probably need special monitoring by a healthcare physician who specializes in problem pregnancies.
Okay.
And what might this, you know, the concern is premature labor and early birth. And so the special monitoring might include additional ultrasounds, concern about early labor, perhaps offering an early birth or cesarean for those pregnancies that might be particularly problematic. But the bottom line there is to have the woman who is pregnant or wishes to become pregnant to be followed by a specialist.
And it's all having to do, that monitoring is all having to do with the possible damage that she may have sustained to the uterine muscle during that irradiation as a kid.
Yes, exactly so. That damage to the uterus restricts the growth of the fetus, and so in instances that we and others have studied, this damage to the uterus results in children being born early, children being born of low birth weight, And now, even at the extreme, children that are not born alive at all, or that are born alive but just live shortly and die shortly after birth.
Well, Dr. Boyce, I want to thank you for your time with us today. I'm looking forward to the follow-up paper that that I hope we'll see soon.
Well, Joe, I've enjoyed talking with you.
Probably the biggest news of the past few weeks concerns rosiglitazone. Both the FDA's advisory panel's mixed vote, plus the news that, according to the New York Times, GlaxoSmithKline had been trying to suppress data on the drug's tendency to raise risks of cardiac events. That story isn't finished, however, because the agency has yet to announce its decision on the drug marketed as Avandia. Of great relevance to emergency services clinicians, having telephone dispatchers tell bystanders to use compression-only CPR works at least as well as encouraging them to use standard CPR. This from randomized trials undertaken in the U.S., U.K., and Sweden on over 3,000 patients. Commentators argue that compression-only CPR is more palatable to bystanders and thus more likely to be performed. Finally, in the practical stuff department, moderate caffeine consumption, the equivalent of about a cup of brewed coffee per day, doesn't seem to increase the risks for miscarriage or preterm birth, according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. You might be surprised at how much caffeine is in non-coffee products, like soft drinks. I've included a link to the Mayo Clinic site on nutrition and healthy eating for a table of caffeine contents and common items. That's it for this week. Let me know what you think. My email address is jelia, J-E-L-I-A, at jwatch.org. Or you can leave a voicemail at 1-617-440-4374. Earlier podcasts are all available at podcasts.jwatch.org. The Journal Watch website is jwatch.org, where you'll find almost 25 years of summaries of the most clinically useful research. It's really a great resource in a never-changing clinical landscape. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adoriano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us in 2 weeks, and thanks for listening.